Tonight's reading is taken from the book of John, chapter 11, verse 1 to 16. Now, a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sister sent to him, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in a day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." After saying these things, he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him." The disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover." Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him."
Thank you, Kenny. Thank you, Clayton. As Clayton mentioned, we're starting this mini-series looking at one chapter called Death and All His Friends, a slight nod to a Coldplay album, if you pick that up. And today, we're looking at perplexity, grief, and despair, three things that are very often connected to suffering and death. And tonight, we're looking at perplexity. You may know the writer C.S. Lewis. He helped a lot of people during his life, helped their faith in particular through his books. But when his wife Joy died, it shook his own faith to the core. Despite all their prayers, God didn't heal her from cancer. And after she died, despite all his prayers, Lewis says that he didn't feel any sense of God's nearness or comfort during that time. And Lewis kind of journaled through that period, and his reflections are captured in a book called A Grief Observed. And at one stage, he wrote this: "Where is God? When you are happy and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence." Now, years earlier, before C.S. Lewis became a Christian, he'd been an atheist. But when his wife died, when his own faith was wavering, he wasn't tempted to go back to atheism. He was tempted instead to think that God is real, but cruel. And he wrote this: "What reason have we, except our own desperate wishes, to believe that God is good? Much evidence seems to point the other way. If God shows kindness for a while, but then keeps his distance in our most desperate moments, what kind of a God is he? So many problems, so much pain and death seem to indicate," this is the heading here, "seem to indicate a supreme being who is cruel." I don't know if his experience resonates with you at all, whether you've known anything of that kind of deep frustration of God not answering your prayers, or if we've had, perhaps we've yet to experience a situation where we've actually seriously questioned God's goodness. And if that is you, if you've yet to question that, then do be thankful, because I know a lot of other people have had these kinds of experiences. But even if we haven't had this kind of experience ourselves, as this comment, which I've heard helpfully made in Forum Times here. It's very useful for us to get the anchors in place before the storm. And so for you and for me, it's good for us to sort these issues through before the trials come. Perhaps you're here, you're looking in at the faith from the outside, and we're very glad that you're here. And for you, maybe this whole question about how can a loving God still allow suffering is one that is a real issue, a real obstacle for you in taking faith seriously. So wherever you might be this evening, I think this passage is a brilliant help for us in thinking through this issue and coming to grips with what I've put on the sheets and what I've called the strangeness of Jesus' love. Let me read from verse 1. Now, a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. Now, these three siblings, they're very dear friends of Jesus. And so obviously when Lazarus, the brother, falls seriously ill, verse 3 says, the sisters sent to Jesus, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. So they naturally look to Jesus because he has this authority to heal. And Jesus' response in verse 4 sounds like great news. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. And you can imagine at that moment, you know, what brilliant news it is. The messengers hear this. They hear what Jesus says. They head straight back to the family with this wonderful assurance of healing. This illness does not lead to death. And back at the family house, you know, there's tremendous relief and joy. And yet, Jesus' words don't seem to be working. And then as the hours go by, Lazarus, instead of getting better, he starts to get worse. And then much, much worse. Until by verse 14 we discover he's dead. And they're thinking, what is going on? You know, isn't Jesus able to keep his promise? Doesn't he care? And actually it gets worse, because as we read on, we discover that this tragedy was actually deliberate. Jesus deliberately stayed where he was for 2 days rather than going to help his friends. Jesus deliberately put his friends through untold misery. First of, I guess, false hope, and then of seeing their dear brother snatched away from them. And although at this stage we don't understand what is going on, the one thing we are told is that none of this contradicts or undermines Jesus' love. In fact, strangely, let's look at verses 5 and 6, and they tell us that all of this is in some way motivated by Jesus' love. Verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So, it's interesting, not all of the translators have the guts to put in so there. It seems so strange in the context. But it is there in the original. So, verse 6, because of Jesus' love, when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. So do you see, Jesus is acting in a way that seems completely incompatible with his love. And yet we're told here that it's precisely because of his love that he's doing it. Now, for you and for me, we might actually know the end of the story. In fact, it's even hinted at in these early verses, verse 11, where Jesus tells the disciples he's going to resurrect Lazarus from the dead. And that's actually what Jesus was really referring to in verse 4 when he said, this illness does not lead to death. He was saying that ultimately, this illness is not going to end in death. It's going to end ultimately in resurrection life. But in deliberately delaying and allowing Lazarus to die, you see, Jesus makes it nearly impossible for them to conceive how on earth he could be acting out of love in this situation. There's a strangeness to Jesus' love. It often doesn't feel like love at all. And we are going to think through how exactly Jesus' actions here are loving. But the point is here that we're told this in advance, in the midst of all the confusion and the perplexity. We're told in advance that his actions are loving. And I think that's so that you and I can learn, even in the midst of our own perplexity, our own frustrations, our own unanswered prayers perhaps, that we're not to judge Jesus' love on the basis of our circumstances. You know, things have gone wrong, so clearly Jesus doesn't love me anymore. But rather, as we're going to see through this passage, we're to judge our circumstances on the basis of Jesus' love. Let me say that again. We're not to judge Jesus' love on the basis of our circumstances, but rather we're to judge our circumstances on the basis of his love. So for those of us who belong to Jesus, Jesus' love is behind everything that happens to us, however frustrating, however painful. And so even though we won't understand often why he's allowed a particular situation, we can trust that as the hymn puts it, which we're going to sing a little later on, behind a frowning providence, there lies a smiling face. When we talk about God's work in our lives, we understandably, don't we? We focus on those instances where prayers have been answered. And of course, that's, you know, wonderful encouragement when we share that with one another. But you see, this passage is about a request for healing in verse 3, which wasn't answered. Faith is not all about answers. In fact, if we do have all the answers, if we understand everything about, you know, God and how he operates, it's very likely that the God that we're talking about is not the Almighty Creator, but rather he's a homemade replica God whom we've shrunk down to our size. Now, faith in the true God is about trusting Jesus' love, even when our prayers aren't answered, when we've got no idea how God might be working in our situation. Now, in lots of areas of life, we hate living with things not quite straight. Perhaps this is more of a struggle for some of us by temperament than others. You know, if we see a picture which is slightly wonky, we immediately want to go and straighten it up. Or we see a jigsaw with a piece missing. It actually makes us feel a little bit queasy. But in this situation, it's as if Jesus is deliberately acting in a way that demands we live with the tension. You know, it's as though he's cemented the picture slightly wonky. Or, you know, the jigsaw piece is deliberately concealed. Jesus has put his friends in a situation here where it's almost impossible to get everything neat and straight by themselves. And where they have to trust him. They just have to wait. And actually, that's one of the reasons, I think, for you and for me, the Christian life can be so difficult very often. Now, having said that there's this deliberate strangeness about Jesus' love, thankfully, we're given accounts like this one in chapter 11, where we see the whole story of why Jesus is acting in the strange way that he does. So that in our situations, when we don't yet have the whole story, which is actually how most of our lives are lived, we can still trust him in the middle of the story. And in these verses, we get two reasons why Jesus acts in the strange way he does. I'll put them there on the sheets. The first one is because there's something worse than death to avoid. Let me read from verse 7. Then, after this, Jesus said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again?" So here, Jesus doesn't simply allow his friends to undergo painful experiences. In these verses, he's actually proposing to lead them straight into a life-threatening environment. But Jesus tells them that they've misunderstood where it is that true danger lies. Verse 9, Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." So Jesus is saying that while ever they're walking in obedience to God, they're effectively untouchable. As Spurgeon put it, "I am immortal until my work is done." So it's not that nothing bad can happen, Jesus is actually going to, shortly he's going to be arrested and killed. It's just that nothing bad that can happen that is outside of God's good purpose for us. But in any case, the real danger, Jesus says, is not the vicious thugs in Judea, those who have already measured up Jesus' coffin size. No, the real danger, Jesus says, is walking in the night. That is walking in disobedience to God's will. That's the thing to really avoid. And we expect Jesus to say in verse 10, if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not around him. But look again, verse 10. He actually says he stumbles because the light is not in him. That is, those who live in disobedience to God essentially show that they're people of darkness, that they're people, as we've seen in John's Gospel, under God's wrath. And actually, that is ultimately a far more dangerous situation to be in than merely being under threat for your life. I wonder if you've ever thought about this fact that death isn't the worst thing in life or the worst thing in the world. These verses tell us that living in disobedience to God is far, far worse. So God thinks it's definitely better to suffer and to die than it is to disobey God. That is why the Old Testament saints endured martyrdom rather than compromise. We saw that recently in Hebrews 11. It's why Peter and the other apostles risked death in order that they would, quote, obey God rather than men, Acts 5. That's why the saints who conquered in Revelation 12 did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. It is always better to obey God and risk death than to be safe and to disobey him. Now, I don't say this flippantly. I'm not trying to belittle death. Death is unspeakably horrific. It's just that Jesus says disobeying God is far worse. You see, death won't separate you from the love of God in Christ Jesus. But disobedience just might. There was a missionary family who I heard about who went to a politically unstable part of Pakistan. And they set up home there, and that meant that they had to get involved in homeschooling their kids. And lots of their friends in their sending church actually criticised them for their decision, you know, heading out there and putting their own children at risk. You know, it's one thing you're going yourselves, putting yourselves in danger, but what you're doing isn't really fair on your children. But these parents explained that their children were actually in far greater danger in terms of being drowned in the godless attitudes of materialism and secularism, which were whilst they were back at their old school, back at home, than they were being homeschooled out in Pakistan. And they could see that for their children, falling into unbelief, falling into disobedience, was a far more serious danger than simply the danger of dying. I guess the people around us are often going to be on this conveyor belt, aren't they? Always towards greater comfort, greater safety, greater luxury. But for those who take Jesus' teaching here seriously, our decisions, perhaps for some staying in a more challenging neighbourhood, will often be incomprehensible to those around us. And part of the reason why death is not the worst thing in the world, we see in these verses, is that for the believer, as I put there on the sheets, death is essentially reversible in any case. Let me read from verse 11. After saying these things, he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him." The disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover." Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest in sleep. So do you see in verse 11, Jesus calls death sleep. Verse 11, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. And if you were here last month, we thought about this when we were looking at Mark 5, that incident where Jesus healed the little girl. So we're not going to spend a lot of time on this now, but The point then and here is that it's as easy for us to wake someone from sleep as it is for Jesus to wake someone from death. So one day Jesus will wake us from the grave to live with him forever if we belong to him. Now, if you and I don't understand what is truly dangerous in this world or what is truly valuable in this world, then we're going to find Jesus' work, what Jesus is doing in our lives, very, very strange. But once we grasp this point that our obedience and our growth in godliness is far more important than even our comfort, then we can start approaching the difficult circumstances of our lives positively. We can start asking the question, well, this situation might not be what I would have chosen for myself, but how can I cooperate with what God is doing here and grow in godliness through it? I was away last week. I was on a Christian camp, and a friend of mine, whilst we were there, got some very bad news. And I said, I'm so sorry, and tried to comfort her. She looked at me and she said, look, this is definitely not plan A, but I know that God has not been caught out by this, and he clearly must have some purpose in it. And I was developing that kind of reflex, that kind of perspective, I think is part of what it means to not judge Jesus' love by our circumstances, but to judge our circumstances by Jesus' love. Asking in any situation, well, what is God's purpose here? How can I grow through it? Now, the second clue I've put there on the sheets as to why Jesus acts in the strange way that he does. It's not simply because there's something worse than death for us to avoid, but also there's something far greater than comfort, far better for us to receive. Now, what could possibly be so important to Jesus that he would willingly allow his friends, which he does here, to experience what I guess would be the worst ordeal in their lives? And we see the answer in verses 14 and 15. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I'm glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. Mary and Martha and Lazarus already trusted in Jesus as a healer. That's why they sent for him. But they didn't yet trust in him as Lord over all, over death. And so Jesus has permitted them here to endure this horrific ordeal so that they and the disciples and all those who would, in a few verses' time, see Lazarus' resurrection and all of this us beyond that who will hear about it, so that all of us would believe that Jesus is Lord even over death. And we're thinking, well, why is this so important? Why is it so important to believe? And if you look a few verses down in verse 25, Jesus answers that question. Verse 25, I am the resurrection and the life, Jesus says. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. See, that's the reason why belief is so important. If we grasp that Jesus is the resurrection and the life, that if we understand that he is Lord even over death, Lord of all, then at that moment, we become death-proof. Though we die, yet shall we live. And then we can look forward with confidence to a future with Jesus, a future which will make sense of everything that has gone before. As Dostoevsky describes it in his book, Brothers Karamazov, in the world's finale, at the moment of eternal harmony, something so precious will come to pass that it will suffice for all hearts, for the comforting of all resentments, and it will justify all that has happened. As someone else said, evil and suffering will not only be ended, but so radically vanquished that what has happened will only serve to make our future life and joy infinitely greater. So do you see, Jesus allows these ordeals, these kinds of uncomfortable things into our lives, just as he does with his friends here, if it will help us to grow in our faith and then be assured of eternal life with him. Now in our final verse, verse 16, we read this. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." I think it's a brilliant response from Thomas. You see, Thomas, he doesn't understand really what's going on. He doesn't understand, as we do, what Jesus is about to do. All he sees is his master heading into the lion's den. But he's still ready to go with him, even if that might mean dying with Jesus. He's a bit like Sam Ganges, you know, heading with Frodo into the heart of Mordor. Just that picture of total loyalty. There's a computer animated film which our family enjoy at the moment called Despicable Me, which you may have seen. It's a good film. And near the end of the film, the little girl, she's in the doorway to an aircraft which is travelling at high speed, flying through the air. And the father figure, Gru, he's in another aircraft. It's computer animated, it's not stuntmen. Another aircraft that is pulled kind of a little bit behind it. And he's about 20 metres away. And he knows that her aircraft is about to be destroyed and she needs to jump off. And he looks at her and he says, "Jump and I will catch you and I will never let you go." She doesn't really understand what's going on. She's frightened. But she trusts Gru. And jumps. And it's just a little picture of, a bit like Thomas here, of not really understanding everything that's going on, but knowing the one who does. And then choosing to trust him. Now you and I have a lot more reasons to trust Jesus than Thomas did here. Not simply because we know what happens at the end of this chapter, but most importantly, we know what happens at the end of the gospel, you know, about the cross. Shortly after C.S. Lewis had that spell and he wrote in his journal that section about God slamming the door on him, a little bit later than that, he was reflecting about the suffering which God had inflicted on his wife. And as he was thinking about the horror of it, the Lord brought to mind for him the suffering of another person, the suffering which the Lord Jesus had endured for him. And as Lewis remembered the love of Jesus shown in suffering on the cross, he describes in the book how his heart was lightened. It was lighter than it had been for several weeks. And he describes how even though the hard questions didn't go away, although the anguish felt the same as it did before, remembering how much Jesus had suffered for him just gave him the perspective he needed to keep trusting God in the midst of the pain. So when those times of perplexity come, those times in our lives when, you know, prayers perhaps go unanswered and it's hard to know what on earth God could possibly be doing in our situation, you and I can remember the cross. And that the cross confirms, beyond doubt, Jesus' extravagant, radical love for us. And although we may still not know what is going on in our situation, like Thomas, we know the one who does. And we can choose to trust him. We're going to sing shortly. And it's a hymn on the sheets written by a guy called William Cooper. This guy became a believer in Jesus actually as a result of reading this chapter, John 11. And he and his friend, John Newton, who was converted as a slave trader, together they gave themselves to trying to compile, write a list of hundreds of hymns for their church. But before Cooper could complete his share, he had what he describes as the fatal dream. Now, he had had all kinds of depressive episodes before, which he describes vividly as lying down in horror and rising up in despair. And he had attempted suicide lots of times in his life. But this time, he says, it was far worse than all those other times. And he was in a state of utter emotional and spiritual anguish. And although he often, in that period, he cried to the Lord to take it away, his prayers were not answered. And it was during that time, as he was battling with his faith, trying to hold on to God in the midst of all this pain, that he wrote this hymn. So I'm going to read verses 3 and 4, which are Cooper's words addressed to us. And they're calling on us to keep trusting the Lord, even in the worst kinds of despair. So let me read verse 3. "You fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face." I'm going to leave a moment's quiet for us to reflect on what the Lord has been saying to us through these verses. And then when the musicians start, we'll stand and we'll sing these two songs together.